It's time for security now. Finally, the long-awaited What the Heck is Going On with Intel Processors Edition. Steve breaks down Meltdown and Spectre. By the way, it's not just for Intel anymore. And talks about what mitigation might involve and what the consequences of fixing this massive flaw could be. There's lots of other security news, too. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 645, recorded Tuesday, January 9th, 2018. The Speculation Meltdown. Security Now is brought to you by IT Pro TV, the fun and entertaining way to sharpen your IT skills. Visit itpro.tv/securitynow and use the code SN30 to get a free 7-day trial and 30% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. And by ZipRecruiter. Looking for your next great hire? ZipRecruiter offers simple tools and powerful matching technology to find you qualified candidates efficiently and effectively. It's the smartest way to hire. Try it free at ZipRecruiter.com/securitynow. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/securitynow. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover security now with Steve Gibson. He is our security minder in chief. Hello, Steve. Good to see you.
Leo, great to be with you again for another week of exciting stuff for the true geek.
It was kind of funny last week because you talked about what were later to be dubbed Spectre and Meltdown. Yep. And you were kind of matter of fact about it. I heard it. In fact, I even mentioned, gee, that sounds kind of like Rowhammer. But I don't know. You must have understood its impact, but I didn't.
I did, and as you know, and I don't like to go like overhyping things and running around with my hair on fire. So I got a little down into the weeds about the performance impact of being forced to flush the virtual memory, the so-called translation look-aside buffer caches, whenever you made a switch from the app to the OS, which is potentially huge. And I got into like explaining what this meant, that it was possible with the Meltdown attack. And so this was the day before then the full disclosures came out that there was so-called Meltdown and also something called Spectre.
Yeah, we didn't know that much on Tuesday because it was just a hint. We hadn't seen the full report
it was
to
from
Wednesday.
Looking, it was like but weird, looking weird at the Unix footprints in the Unix source comments had been redacted that normally wouldn't be, and the explainer page for the changes was missing, and it was like and then news that Microsoft had been scurrying around. I mean, there wasn't anything definitive. Now we know way more. So I titled today's podcast "The Speculation Meltdown" because sort of taking more of the 10,000-foot view of this, believe it or not, there was a paper written in 1992 which recognized this problem.
What?
25 years
what?
Ago.
Oh, that's not good.
And it was then referred to in more detail 3 years later in 95 about like how this kind of thing could happen. And back then, it was, that would be too hard or no one's going to bother with that. And so the industry and, not just Intel, but as we know now, all of the major chip vendors, AMD and ARM, are all subject to these problems. The reason is that this has been the way, this so-called speculation has been the way all high-performance modern processor architectures are able to continue to squeeze phenomenal performance out of the system. And so this is not just Intel, as we know. And in fact, I was distressed to see that there were some class action suits that were being filed immediately in knee-jerk reaction to this, and which I regard as absolutely unfortunate. But anyway, we'll get to all that. I formulated a general law of cross-task information leakage, which reads, in any setting where short-term performance optimizations have global effect, a sufficiently clever task can infer the recent history of other tasks by observing its own performance. And that I've worked on that for for a while. In any setting where short-term performance optimizations have global effect, a sufficiently clever task can infer the recent history of other tasks by observing its own performance. Which that's like the meta statement of the problem, the how there has always been, and that's what's so interesting about this. There has always been this problem. And it's and what happened was that sort of, I mean, and this is classic security paradigm that we see over and over and over, is that something that was sitting there for a long time, somebody stubbed their toe on and said, ow, wait a minute, what's that doing? And suddenly it's a big deal. So we're going to have fun at the end of the podcast talking about the, again, sort of not like which patch to apply or, you know, what to do immediately, but where this problem came from. Why, what's the origin of something which, without overhyping it, is probably not overstating it to call it an industry-wide catastrophe.
Wow.
But there are a few other things to talk about as well. We're going to examine an interesting change in, well, I wrote Microsoft's policy, but I'm more of a Microsoft implementation regarding non-Microsoft antiviral systems that appeared last Wednesday on the 3rd. An interesting comparison of Firefox Quantum's browser performance when tracking protection is enabled or disabled. Some very worrisome hard coding backdoors, which were discovered in 10 of Western Digital's MyCloud drives, since patched, now public, but we want to make sure anybody with a MyCloud drive knows about this because they're incredibly bad. And if at first with WEP, and at second with WPA, and at third with WPA2, and at fourth with WPS, you don't succeed.
try WPA3.
try yet again with WPA3, exactly. And here we have another crucial cryptographic system being developed by a closed, members-only committee, as all the past failures of the Wi-Fi Alliance have been. It boggles the mind that in this day, that can still be the way we're doing things when, again, five strikes so far. And, okay, they're getting warmer, so we'll see. So I think a great podcast for us.
A nice bunch of stuff. But before we go any farther, perhaps I should mention our fine sponsor, IT Pro TV. You know, I really have to thank Tim and Don and the IT Pro TV gang because they have been such supporters of not only this show, although I think it's a mutual benefit because every time I meet somebody who listens to Security Now, they are, oh, yeah, I learned about IT Pro TV on Security Now, and they're now doing it. And when we went to the grand opening at IT Pro TV, everybody practically who was there, from the people who worked there to the fans who came, we're all Security Now listeners, so there's kind of a natural match. What is IT Pro TV? Well, if you're in IT or you want to get in IT, and I imagine that's pretty much everybody who listens to the show, if whether it's the IT for your family or as a business or as a job, you know the training, learning, it's something you never stop doing. There's always more to learn. Why else do you listen to Security Now, right? There's always something new to learn. IT Pro TV was started by Tim Broom and Don Pezet. Their idea, they were IT trainers, right? They taught people how to get, to prepare them. They were test preppers. They taught them how to prepare for the cert tests so they could get their first job in IT. And they thought, you know what would be really cool is to do kind of like TWiT, like a internet television channel that devoted itself to IT training, not just getting the certs, but then keeping up after you get the job, getting a better job in IT. And that's how IT Pro TV was born. And immediately soared. They now have 125 hours of new programming every week because they have five studios, most of them running Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. I mean, they're really, at least, they're always doing something. And because of that, they have thousands of hours of on-demand videos you can download. You can watch them anywhere. They have apps for every possible platform: Chromecast, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV. Of course, you can watch them at the website on your PC. They have iOS and Android apps. So it's a really great way. What I, would do is I'd put it up on the big screen at home in the morning while you're eating. Get, fire it up on the Roku or the Chromecast, the Apple TV. Then as you're ready to go to work, open up the app, continue to listen. And the app, as you get in the car, drive to work. When you get to work, put it up on your PC in a little window and continue to learn. And, it's one of those things your boss is going to let you, encourage you to watch. In fact, we know a lot of IT teams that have team subscriptions with IT Pro TV. It's a really good way to expand your team's abilities, your knowledge. Courses include everything, certainly security. And by the way, and we've said this before, there is a massive gap between the number of professionals needed in computer security and the number of professionals available. It's something like 1 million open jobs. I mean, it is incredible. So if you got into computer security, you could write your own ticket. So get that Certified Ethical Hacker, CEH cert, or the CISM or CISA or CRISC or CISSP, or learn how to use Kali Linux, which is a great pen testing Linux, or you can learn Linux security techniques. Get the ITIL certs, the ISC squared security certs. All of them are being taught at IT Pro TV. Just check the calendar for upcoming courses or watch the on-demand courses. In many cases, there's hours and hours. I can't remember a CEH. I mean, that's like 100 hours of great programming. You can really, and you'll enjoy it because they're engaging teachers. They have a chat room just like we do going at the same time. They have online study groups. They have practice exams. Join the more than, they have now 85,000 IT Pro TV members. And I'm going to guess about 55,000 of them are Security Now listeners. Go to itpro.tv/securitynow. If you like what you're hearing with Steve, you're going to love IT Pro TV. itpro.tv/securitynow. Find out how IT Pro TV can offer your team the best IT training solution. I got to mention that. They've got a great team portal where you can assign, you can track people's trainings. You really keep your team up to speed. Or as an individual, you can go there and get a 7-day free trial and save 30% on your active subscription. As long as you stay active, 30% forever on your monthly subscription when you use the offer code SN30. Let me recap. itpro.tv/securitynow, offer code SN30. And if you're going to find out about the team solution, you can sign up for a free demo of the supervisor portal there too as well. itpro.tv/securitynow, offer code SN30. Try it free for 7 days, 30% off. Friendly training, binge-worthy content, and life-changing results at itpro.tv. All right, Steve, you have a picture?
So our picture of the week, yes.
Oh, yes.
Is wow. It's more what I was expecting when I said last week that the consequence of being forced to flush the page lookup tables to me was mind-boggling. You know, I'm old school, and I don't really believe any of this works. That can't get off the ground. So, you know, the idea is, as I was explaining last week, the virtual memory mapper in Intel architectures is this three-level lookup table where the address that you're fetching isn't the actual physical address at all. It's an index into a table, which is an index into a table, which is an index into a table. And you need all of those in order to figure out what the value is. And you do cache the result, and those tables are cached. And that's what's called the TLB, the translation look-aside buffer, because there's this notion in general in computing that something you've done recently, you are more likely to do again than not. And the classic example is looping. If you are looping over some code, that means you go back to the top and you do it again with different values or for, you know, different inputs or something. But so that says that, oh, look, I'm rerunning instructions that I recently ran. So this is why the whole concept of caching makes sense. We have dynamic memory, the main motherboard, you know, the whatever it is, 4, 8, 16 gigabytes of main RAM. Due to the technology, it fell behind a long time ago in keeping up with our processors. They just no one has been able to make main memory go fast. Now, we've talked about little interesting ideas. There's some cross-wire technology that HP's kind of trying to get off the ground. Intel has it too, cross-point. So maybe we'll see something dramatic happen. But so far, main memory is compared to the way our processors have just leaped ahead in speed, it's the laggard. So it's necessary to use this notion of reusing something or hoping that you're going to be able to reuse something you recently slowly fetched from main memory again. So all of these modern chips have on-chip caches. And you mentioned L1, L2, L3. They're in a hierarchy. The ones closest to the chip are the fastest and the smallest. And then there's a next level further back, and then a third level, and they each get larger and sometimes slower, but also it's more of a function of access patterns. When you've got multiple cores, now you've got different processor cores all competing with each other for sharing this common pool of cache, all which is trying to provide, not just arrange to feed these hungry chips data as quickly as they need it. So also shared are these virtual memory lookup tables. And so what I was saying last week was, you know, the idea that crossing from the user land, user code to the kernel would require the flushing of that incredibly valuable because it's so slow to get it to load it. The idea that it would force the flushing of that cache was just like, you know, as I said, I don't really believe any of this works to start with. I've sort of reluctantly agreed that, okay, Wi-Fi seems to be working somehow at ridiculous speeds, you know, and when modems started going to 56K, it's like, what? No, modems go at 300 baud or maybe 12, but, you know, not 56K, but yeah, they somehow did. So this picture demonstrates what happened on one of three of Epic Games servers when they installed the meltdown mitigation. And this is much more in keeping with what I expected. So you can't see it, but there are three chart lines. There's green, orange, and blue, as there's a little index down in the lower left, a little key showing them. And so, and what you see is this sine wave, which anyone who's run a big server is familiar with. That's the diurnal cycle of CPU being busy. You notice it hits a nadir. They're all kind of lowest around 4 a.m. And I'm not sure if this is, you know, UTC or what time zone, but then it also peaks pretty much on the opposite side of the day. And so that's just sort of generally people are sleeping and then they're waking up and doing stuff. Well, that sudden jump is one of the three processors, the green trace, where meltdown mitigation was applied. And it's about 2.5 times. If you look at the low point there of all the traces, just before 4 a.m., you can see that it crosses right around 10%. And now if you look up at the green line, it's more than 25%. It's maybe about 27%, whereas the other guys are at 10. So for their use case, the meltdown mitigation jumped their processor's utilization, a CPU utilization, by about 2.7, which I believe, based on the severity of the need to discard this slow-to-acquire cache data every time you switch between the kernel and the user. So this is the kind of picture that is what I was expecting, rather than this, you know, we've heard, 1% or point something or maybe 5. It's like, okay, you know, again, it is completely a function of what you're doing. We've talked
how much kernel mode access you need compared to how much user mode.
Well, actually, it's how much crossing. It's the boundary crossing.
Right. So if you go into the kernel and you read, and then you exit the kernel,
right,
then there's that one swap then. But if you go back and forth, that's when you're going to get the biggest hit, right? Because you don't want user mode to have access to kernel mode information. So you flush the cache. You go into user mode, and then you go back to kernel mode. Do they flush it twice? Do they flush it when you go back into the kernel mode? No, you wouldn't need to then.
Correct. You don't need to flush it when you go from the kernel. I mean, when you go from the user to the kernel, because we trust the kernel.
Right.
There's no malware there. It's user code looking at the residual from being in the kernel. And so it's when you switch to the user that the kernel needs to remove its what I described last week as footprints, you know, because essentially and this comes back to that statement I made in any setting where and caching is a perfect example. It's not speculation. We'll talk about that in a second. But in any setting where short-term performance optimizations have global effect, a sufficiently clever task can infer the recent history of other tasks by observing its own performance. In other words, so caching is a short-term performance optimization. And if the cache is global, that is, if everybody gets the benefit of it, then clever tasks can figure out what's in the cache and what isn't by making a fetch and observing how long it takes, observing its own performance. And so the 20,000 view, the 20,000 foot view here is that the way we've been cruising for the last several decades is we've been creating faster performance by creating processors that are increasingly clever about optimizing what they expect to have happen next. But that expectation, whether it's cash or whether it's specular architecture that we'll be talking about, speculation, that inherently allows these kinds of problems. And so that's why this is, as I said before, this is industry shaking. I mean, this, again, this has always been sitting there. Nobody really worried about it until now. Everybody's worrying about it. So,
and we don't know really who knew about it and when. I mean, we learned
true.
About it now, but who knows? Although, it feels like this is, and this is the other thing I've been speculating on, and I can't remember if it was Bruce Schneier or Brian Krebs talked about the synchronicity, the fact that two different teams simultaneously discovered this. I would guess security researchers kind of run down similar avenues.
Four teams. Well, if you broaden the window a little bit, within a couple of months, and that was Bruce talking about this.
Bruce, okay.
And
yeah.
there is a security community. There's conferences. There's papers being published. Everybody's reading everything,
right.
And so it's not like there's been no cross pollination at all. So it may have been, for example, that last summer somebody did something. Or, you know, like cash timing is that's now a thing.
Well, and Roehammer, maybe something like
exactly.
That.
Exactly. Yeah, so there's sort of there is something kind of in the air where individual researchers will, you know, kind of think, I'm going to spend some time thinking about this, you know, and because they're often researching in a silo within their own group or their own team or their own university or their own corporation, you know, they're wanting to produce results that are, you know, proprietary until they're publicly disclosed, especially if it's something like this where they have to, you know, whisper what they found to the parties who are affected. Then they're not going to be talking about it. So it is interesting, but not surprising that suddenly this just kind of all happened. It was probably set up by, you know, again, just sort of what was in the air in the last few years and eventually bound to happen.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We'll get to that further in a minute. Now, you're going to have to pay attention to this one, Leo, because you'll be wanting to talk about this. This is really strange. Okay, I don't know how to read between the lines. This is from last Wednesday, January 3rd, 2018, title on Microsoft, on support.microsoft.com, titled Important: Windows Security Updates Released January 3rd, 2018, and Antivirus Software. And Microsoft wrote, Microsoft has identified a compatibility issue with a small number of antivirus software products. The compatibility issue arises when antivirus applications make unsupported calls into Windows kernel memory. This is something you and I have been talking about now for a while. That is the problem with instability being created by AV, which is running in the kernel. And in order to get the hooks it needs, they're doing unofficially supported things. So Microsoft writes, the compatibility issue arises when antivirus applications make unsupported calls into Windows kernel memory. These calls may cause stop errors, also known as blue screen errors, that make the device unable to boot. To help prevent stop errors that are caused by incompatible antivirus applications, Microsoft is only offering the Windows security updates that were released on January 3rd, 2018, to devices that are running antivirus software that is from partners who have confirmed that their software is compatible with the January 2018 Windows Operating System Security Update. Okay, so listen to that. So Microsoft is only offering the Windows security updates that were released last week to devices that are running antivirus software that is from partners who've confirmed that their software is compatible. Okay, what are the mechanisms of that? How does that work? Okay, get this. Believe it or not, there's a new registry entry. And if you don't do this, you stop getting updates. That is, if you're running Windows without antivirus, which is affirmatively set that registry key to say, yes, I'm compatible, proceed with the updates, you don't get them. Now, if you don't have antivirus at all,
that key, will that matter?
Yes. Get this. Down on the second page, if you scroll down from what you're showing on the screen, under customers without antivirus. I had to read this like three times to make sure what? In cases where customers can't install or run or choose not to antivirus software, Microsoft recommends manually setting the registry key as described below in order to receive the January 2018 security updates. In other words, you just don't get them. If you don't do anything, and if you've decided I don't want antivirus, then that nothing sets that key.
But I think Defender counts. Defender changes the key. So it would proactively disabling Defender, which is installed by default on Windows 8, 8, 1, and 10.
Correct.
But the weirdest situation is there are a number of antiviruses that fixed the kernel calls but didn't set the key. Defender does, though. So you should be using Defender. And most and people
that's
are.
That's what you and I have been saying now for some time is I know that there are a lot of people who have been using some whatever their AV is for decades, and they're just sticking with it. But these kinds of problems occur. So, yeah.
Also what we've been talking about is don't use a third-party antivirus because they do things like these unauthorized kernel accesses.
Right.
It's not good. Right. I remember when Microsoft came out with Windows 7 – they were deprecating this and said, don't do this because we're going to prevent you from doing this. And I thought that they did, but I guess they didn't.
They backed down. Yes, there's antitrust issues. Yeah. You know, nobody – like what happened to third-party firewalls? Well, you know, those went the way of the whatever. They're gone. There's still third-party AV. Now, their document does say for Windows 7 – and Server 2008 R2, which is the equivalent server version of the Windows 7, in a default installation of Windows 7 SP1 or Windows Server 2008 R2 SP1, customers will not have an antivirus application installed by default. In these situations, Microsoft recommends installing a compatible and supported antivirus application, such as Microsoft Security Essentials, or a third-party AV application. The antivirus software must set a registry key as described below in order to receive, that is, in order for the user to receive the January 2018 security updates. And I should also mention, just like, it's not just this month. Down in their Q&A, they ask themselves the question, how long will Microsoft require setting a registry key? And basically, from now on, that is, if this doesn't happen, if something doesn't set that key, you never get them again. So,
part of it, and I'm reading between the lines in this bulletin, is that if you do have the blue screen because you install an incompatible program, Microsoft can't guarantee that you can fix it. That, it could be permanently screwing up. You'd have to reinstall Windows.
Yeah.
Terrible. What a mess.
So anyway, just now, and in Microsoft's defense, I mean, we know this is a pain for Microsoft. That is third-party AV. Anything that is allowed into the kernel that starts poking around and hooking things that it's not supposed to and using undocumented calls. Clearly what happened is with this month's release, Microsoft changed something. Well, they're allowed to change their own kernel because it's theirs. But antivirus that wasn't verified against these patches, and how could it be if Microsoft just said, oh, here's a patch? You know, I'm sure that that change collapsed some things, and Microsoft said, oh, crap, you know, we can't push this out to users who have incompatible AV. They'll get blue screens. So they created the registry key to create a trapdoor that would prevent the update if, the, you know, like prevent the update from installing itself if this key did not exist or was not set properly. So again, this is not Microsoft's fault, but it all does sort of create a little pressure against third-party AV. I mean, there's probably enough pressure against third-party AV already that this doesn't really, as a, you know, in the big grand scheme of things, make much difference in terms of being more pressure. But again, as we have been saying, it's another reason just to use Security Essentials or Defender or whatever and just let it, you know, take care of you. So I thought, anyway, an interesting bit of information that I wanted to make sure our listeners knew about in case somebody had shut down their Microsoft AV in Windows 10 or didn't have Security Essentials or anything else from Microsoft installed in Windows 7 and is kind of scratching their head, hey, where's my update? Especially this week when everybody's wanting updates like crazy important.
Well, we'll get into another reason why you may not get the update in a little bit, too.
Yeah, that's right. So, AMD. Anyway, so somebody sent me a tweet from Jason Kint, probably Simon Zarafa. So thank you, Simon, if it was you. I didn't make a note of who forwarded it to me, so I'm sorry if it was somebody else, not Simon, but thank you anyway. So Jason tweeted, seriously, drop Chrome. Download latest version of Firefox called Quantum. And turn on tracking protection in the settings. Tracking protection will also help mitigate ad fraud. And, Jason writes, it's Google's Achilles heel. So I thought, okay, what? So I did some digging, and this is a little interesting. Okay, first of all, that chart you're showing is, you know, needs to be treated with some skepticism. It's Mozilla's chart. However, if it's to be believed, it shows that Chrome average page load time per browser was 7.7 seconds. Chrome Incognito didn't change, 7.7. Firefox Quantum normal mode was a little touch faster at 7.3 seconds. But turn on private browsing with Firefox Quantum, and it's down. It drops by more than 50% down to less than 50% to 3.2 seconds. I also wanted to take a moment to note that I heard Andy in last week's MacBreak Weekly give a shout out. Surprisingly, you know, he was jumping up and down, and I think other Twit hosts or people on the network in general, I mean, it's more than just me noting, holy crap, Quantum is really fast. In fact, you, Leo, I think, had noted that the latest Firefox browser, Quantum, was a so-called quantum leap forward in performance. But I got a kick out of hearing Andy saying, wow, you know, he's running them side by side, and, you know, his measure is where does he generally end up opening new tabs or something. Right, he had sort right. of a
but you heuristic. Get even more benefit if you turn on tracking protection. That's a huge, apparently, difference.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so what Mozilla wrote was that most browser performance benchmarks focus on the use of a regular browsing mode. But what about private browsing? Given that private browsing use is so common, and they linked to a DuckDuckGo private browsing PDF, which has some interesting stats in it. I mean, it's like for people who – there are a lot of people who have never heard of it, don't know what it is, so obviously never use it. But there are people who know about it. And from time to time, typically the example was when doing a search for something embarrassing, they would turn on private browsing in order to, you know, not leave footprints behind. But anyway, apparently it is like maybe 50% of users use it with some regularity, who know that it exists. And of course, there's a big chunk of people who don't know. Anyway, Mozilla says, we wanted to see how Firefox's private browsing compared with Chrome's incognito when it came to page load time, that time between a click and the page being fully loaded on the screen. Now, I want to mention that the contention is that tracking script is slowing things down. But tracking script may not matter visually. So it's one thing to say, oh, look how fat, you know, look at our instrumentation that showed how long it took for everything the browser needed to fetch to finally get fetched. But that may not represent the user's experience. So what I want to do is I want to plant the seed in our listener's ear that, well, see how your own mileage is with this. You know, try it yourself. But so what their results were, across the top 200 news websites tested, the average page load for Firefox Quantum browsing, private browsing, as I mentioned, was 3.2. Everybody else was like 7.7. So like 2.4 times faster than Chrome in incognito mode. But and so the primary reason for the dramatic difference, they write, is that Mozilla's private browsing mode automatically activates tracking protection, whereas Chrome's incognito mode does not. So first of all, okay, that's of interest, because you'd sort of think that if you're in private browsing or incognito, you'd like to have tracking protection off. Well, Chrome keeps it going, and by default, Mozilla's Firefox Quantum turns it off. The takeaway here, though, is that anyone using Firefox Quantum can change that setting. It is possible to flip a switch. You go to Privacy and Security, scroll down to find the Tracking Protection section, and you can change it from tracking protection during private browsing or always. And so what they're asserting is that you could probably, with Firefox Quantum, obtain the benefit of that speed. And again, instrumentation measurement versus how it feels maybe two different things. That is, if scripts continue to load in the background that are only for tracking, but they don't slow down your browsing experience, then okay, it's sort of folded into the, you know, you looking at the page and figuring out what's going on, and it may not matter. But I wanted to let our listeners know that tracking protection can be set to always, and certainly lower your bandwidth consumption, apparently significantly. Maybe you'll see an increase in performance. And Mozilla did note that when enabling this for always, keep in mind that tracking protection may block social like buttons, commenting tools, and some cross-site video content. So you may find a bit of a compatibility problem. And probably if you're already running with uBlock Origin enabled by default, it's probably already doing a lot of this speed up. And there you have the ability, as we've discussed, of disabling it on a per site basis, or if something seems broken on the page, you can try turning it off and maybe things will go better. But what we have seen is that, unfortunately, the tracking's, and think about what that means in terms of speed. That means that more than half of a page load time is now blocked by tracking protection, which says this stuff that we don't see, but which is increasingly JavaScript and busy doing stuff, not always, for our benefit, is now taking up a substantial percentage of the pages of the top 200 news sites. And also, that's another point. It might be that represents top 200 news sites could be a bit of a skew from where we normally go. Just there may be more, news sites are generally trying to keep themselves alive by generating revenue. And
any site with an ad, almost every site with an ad will be blocked. The ads will be, it's kind of effectively an ad blocker. So you should be aware of that. That if you're going to a site you like, you are disabling their ability to monetize you entirely, not just with ads, but with tracking of, like Google Analytics. They can't even tell you're there. So I understand people's privacy concerns, but don't think that using it always is anything less than an ad blocker, because it's effectively an ad blocker. You're telling a site that you visit, whether it's Engadget, The Verge, or Twit, we don't want you to monetize us.
Actually, it's a little better than that, because it uses a curated list. And if a site does obey the DNT, the do not track, then it's not on that list. So,
yeah, but if you have ads, you're going to have – we obey do not track, but we don't personally, but because we have ads, it will block the ads on our site.
Period. Oh, okay.
So – unless they have first-party ads or somehow they're doing an ad server that doesn't – we even run our own ad servers so that people don't – we do everything we can to protect people's privacy, and you still block the ads on our site. So, I don't, you're basically saying, no, I don't want to give you any money. So I just – something to be aware of.
Yeah. Well, and as we've discussed, sites are increasingly detecting that and saying, hey, we need to be able to show you ads in order to support ourselves. Right. Please consider allowing the ads to come through so we can make some money and stay
on
the air.
And then maybe people will disable their ad blocker, but if they have tracking protection on, they're not changing it. I think that's part of the problem I have, is that you're doing ad blocking without knowing it.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
So for quite some time, it turns out that Western Digital and apparently D-Link also, but primarily Western Digital, MyCloud drives had a hard – it's hard to even believe this – a hard-coded backdoor. It got a lot of coverage in the last week. A researcher, James Bersgay, with Gulf Tech Research and Development, discovered and reported the flaws to WD, to Western Digital, back in this last summer, June of 2017. He then waited patiently for Western Digital to release firmware updates. He took a close look at several of the MyCloud drives, 10 of them, by the way. I think there were 2 that weren't affected, 10 were. So, and he found a bunch of problems. They allowed unrestricted file upload, so that, for example, a PHP file found on the WD's MyCloud's built-in web server allowed an attacker to upload files to the device. He was able to use the flaw to upload web shells to the device, which in turn granted him control over it. There was, as I mentioned, a hard-coded backdoor, which was present in every single one of these MyCloud drives. And the reason that there's some obviously D-Link connection is that the admin username was mydlink, BRIONYG, and the password was ABC12345CBA. So, so this is sitting in all of the drives. The point of them is to be on the internet, exposed, so that you're able to access them. And they all have a hard-coded backdoor, which would have allowed anyone who discovered it, and who knows who did until this was fixed, to have full access to your drive. And there was a cross-site request forgery bug that could be exploited to execute pranks and rogue commands. For example, you could change the device's interface language so that it would, when you brought the website up, it would be in a language you didn't speak and had a hard time even changing back because you couldn't find the button to do that. So the middle of last month, mid-December, an independent and highly detailed disclosure of the vulnerabilities was publicly posted by somebody else. And so the good news is that Western Digital had fixed this in November, so the month before. So the takeaway for our listeners is you want to make sure that you're at firmware 2.30.174 or later, or just if you're a MyCloud, a WD MyCloud Drive user, definitely update your firmware, your drive's firmware to the latest, which will have that all of those bugs, including the hard-coded backdoor, removed, because you don't want your WD drive and all of its contents probably globally accessible and able to execute root, bad guys. Oh, and these are wormable. So this was a wormable set of bugs that would have allowed, had this gotten loose, it would have been a part of a MirrorEye botnet in a few weeks, because they would have added it to the code and the drives would have been out scanning for each other and becoming compromised. So not good. And a Metasploit module now exists, making this easy to do. I looked at the documentation through Metasploit, and there's nothing particularly new or newsworthy that I didn't already talk about. Basically, they're just covering the same sort of stuff. And Leo, I'm thirsty.
Well, good, because I...
And we know what that means.
I want you to caffeinate. I really do. It's,
I got my big white mug.
Seriously, is that a liter? What the hell is that? That's like a beer stein for coffee.
It's the white out. It's the
no
white
one should,
out.
No one should ever drink that much coffee. Except Steve. He's got immunity. He's conditioned his system. Our show today brought to you by ZipRecruiter. If you're looking for the next great hire, if you're the person responsible for this, I hope you know about ZipRecruiter. If you don't, I'm going to rock your world right now. ZipRecruiter is the easiest way to hire. Simple tools, powerful matching technology will help you find qualified candidates efficiently, effectively. It'll be less of a burden on you, and your company will be so grateful because you'll hire the right person fast. It's just the smartest way to hire. ZipRecruiter.com/security now to try it free. This year, let ZipRecruiter help you build your business with the perfect hires. No one's done a better job of transforming how you find the right talent than ZipRecruiter. First of all, the obvious, the front line, the top line, they post your single posting to ZipRecruiter to over 100 of the web's leading job boards. One click, that's it. Boom, you're on 100-plus job boards. Then they go another step. They actively look for the most qualified candidates and actually invite them to apply. It's like having a headhunter working for you. ZipRecruiter even reviews every application and identifies the top candidates. It says, oh, look at this one. Here's a good one. Wouldn't that be great? It's like a perfect assistant. This is why ZipRecruiter is not like any other hiring site. It doesn't depend on the right candidates finding you. It goes out and finds them. Let me give you the stat that really seals the deal. 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter, 80% get a quality candidate through the site in a little as one day. Wouldn't you love to post your site today and have a great candidate tomorrow? Phenomenal. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of every size to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. Post them free on ZipRecruiter right now. Free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/security now. Do that free trial. ZipRecruiter.com/security now. You can thank me later. Promise you it'll rock your world. If you're doing the hiring, ZipRecruiter.com/security now. Caffeinated Steve is always more fun than fatigued Steve. You don't get fatigued. You're nope. Like the Energizer bunny.
Yep.
Yep.
I am.
Yep.
So how not to ever learn the lesson. Announce yet another Wi-Fi specification developed in secret. And boy, are these guys proprietary. So this is, get this, Wi-Fi Alliance, and then we have the circle R. So remind us that that's a registered mark.
Hell yeah.
Yep, circle R. Introduces security enhancements. And their announcement, and this was yesterday at CES, new Wi-Fi, circle R. Yep, that's our trade. We also own that. Registered trademark. Security features available in 2018. Now, okay, you know, that's good. Except, so Dateline, Las Vegas, Nevada, January 8th, 2018. Wi-Fi Alliance, circle R, introduces enhancements and new features for Wi-Fi protected access. Oop, circle R, we own that phrase also. The Ascent, we don't have good security, but boy, we got our trademark patent attorneys there. They've locked down all of these phrases that you have to give them credit for. The essential family of Wi-Fi certified. That's all caps. Oh, and that's a TM, trademark on that.
Oh, my
security
God.
security technologies for more than a decade. Yes, and we're suffering through him for more than a decade. Wi-Fi Alliance is launching configuration, authentication, and encryption enhancements because, you know, we haven't got it right yet. That's me. They didn't say that. Across its portfolio to ensure Wi-Fi certified TM devices continue to implement state-of-the-art security protections. Somehow they didn't trademark that phrase. WPA2, trademark TM, provides reliable security used in billions of Wi-Fi, circle R, we own that phrase, devices every day and will continue to be developed in anyway, it goes on like that. I won't bore our listeners. Anyway, they've trademarked and circle R'd every possible phrase that they want to make sure they get credit for. Unfortunately, they're still struggling to get the security correct. As I said, we went through WEP, WPA, WPA2, then we had the single button configuration where it turns out you didn't have to guess all, remember, all eight digits at all. The eighth one was a check digit. You could guess them in two separate sets of four and then three, totally shredding that security. So these guys, I mean, they just cannot get it right. However, there are, you know, they're going to keep trying. And what I wanted, the useful bit of information here is that there will be a WPA3. They're being mum about what it will have. That is to say, no open spec, no ability for actual industry academics and non-paying members of the Wi-Fi Alliance, circle R, registered trademark, to see what they're doing, but we'll have a chance to take a look at it after everybody has already got it deployed, and with any luck, maybe they will have made fewer mistakes. So they say four new capabilities for personal and enterprise Wi-Fi networks will emerge in 2018 as part of, wait for it, Wi-Fi certified, all caps, WPA3 trademark. Two of the features will deliver, they are saying, robust protections. We don't know that, of course, until somebody else sees them. Even when the users choose passwords that fall short of typical complexity recommendations. So, maybe they're implementing some sort of password-based key derivation function, which would be handy. Everybody else has that now. Will simplify the process of configuring security for devices that have limited or no display interface. Okay, sounds good. You know, IoT stuff, light bulbs and so forth. Another feature, they write, will strengthen user privacy in open networks through individualized data encryption. Now, that sounds great. Let's hope they get it right. Some speculation that I found suggests that maybe what they will be implementing is a a Diffie-Hellman key agreement. We've talked about how that works in the past, where anyone can observe the two endpoints sending stuff back and forth to mutually arrive at a key. And even while seeing all of the back and forth traffic, still be unable to know what the key is. So the presumption is that maybe there will be some sort of a public key agreement protocol like Diffie-Hellman, which will then be used to encrypt the standard WPA encryption, which would allow what's known as opportunistic encryption, meaning that if you have WPA3 at each end, and that'll take some length of time for access points to come up to speed, for example, in coffee shops and so forth and restaurants and airports. But the idea would be that no longer would your non-password-based Wi-Fi connections be subject to simple eavesdropping. And that's a great step forward. So again, if they didn't screw it up in implementation and definition, then yay, that would be good. And finally, they say a 192-bit security suite. I guess for whatever reason, probably performance maybe, they're not wanting to jump all the way to 256 where everybody else is, but they're, you know, it's better than 128. So they're saying that that's aligned with the commercial national security algorithm suite from the Committee on National Security Systems. And I don't know who any of those people are. We've never talked about them before. The CNSA. Oops, it's got NSA in its name. Well, okay. Will further protect Wi-Fi networks with higher security requirements such as government, defense, and industrial. And maybe this fifth shot will be better than the previous four. Let's hope. So anyway, they've got their trademarks all over everything. WPA3 announced yesterday at CES will happen apparently sometime this year. And sounds like it's got some good new features. So good for that. My only wish is that it were being developed the way other open systems are, where you've got you freely invite the community of people who know a lot to take a look at it. Because in the past, when that community of people who know a lot have looked at every single thing this Wi-Fi Alliance has ever done, they found serious glaring problems with it. But again, that's not the way they want to play the game. Also, and this is my last piece of news before we get to some miscellany stuff and then talk about the speculation meltdown, is that the Let's Encrypt gang are celebrating their success in 2017 and have talked about their plans for 2018. In their looking forward to 2018 posting yesterday, actually it was dated 12th, last month. They said, Let's Encrypt had a great year in 2017. We more than doubled the number of active unexpired certificates we service to 46 million. We just about tripled the number of unique domains we service to 61 million. And we did it all while maintaining a stellar security and compliance track record. And we'll talk about that in a minute. Most, they write, importantly, though, the web went from 46% encrypted page loads to 67%, according to statistics from Mozilla, a gain of 21 percentage points in a single year. They write, incredible. And I agree, that's great. They said, we're proud to have contributed to that. And we'd like to thank all the other people and organizations who also worked hard to create a more secure and privacy-respecting web. They write, then they finish with a paragraph, while we're proud of what we accomplished in 2017, we're spending most of the final quarter of the year, that is 2017, looking forward rather than back. As we wrap up our own planning process for 2018, we'd like to share some of our plans with you, including both the things we're excited about and the challenges we face. So in summary, where they go with this post is that they're going to be giving us a next generation of their ACME protocol, which will support some additional features. They will, during 2018, be allowing the use of wildcard certificates for the first time. So you'll be able to get a star.domain.com or whatever, which will then allow that single cert to be used on multi-home systems within that domain or on multiple machines, behind a network concentrator, whatever, rather than each with a different domain name, rather than requiring that each of those machines obtain its own certificate. And they're going to be adding an elliptic curve, an ECDSA, elliptic curve route to their route that will then allow them to be issuing elliptic curve certificates, which are have lower computational overhead, higher performance, and that's good looking forward. All of what they wrote is true, but it is also true that an inevitable consequence of the automation of DV, that is domain validation certificates, which is what they're issuing, is fraud. While it's true that a greater percentage of the web is encrypted, and that's good, it is also unfortunately true that a phenomenal number, and we've discussed this in the past, a phenomenal number of Let's Encrypt issued certificates are fraudulent. They are being used for fraudulent purposes. And again, there's nothing to have prevented that from happening with domain validation certs before Let's Encrypt, but the automation of this process has really taken the lid off, and the numbers are of fraudulent certs being used essentially to spoof security and get the closed padlock and better treatment in the browser URL to seduce people into believing they are where they're not is phenomenal. So while yes, it's good that more of our connections are encrypted, it was inevitable that I think that we were going to see a significant jump in the abuse of this kind of automated cert issuance, and indeed we have. And this is a note I got middle of December of last month on the 19th that caught my eye. I mentioned it tangentially last week, I think, or the week before. The subject was, thanks for giving me $728 with four exclamation points.
Oh, yeah, and you mentioned this from the drip, the Bitcoin faucet.
Yes, exactly. It's someone named David L. in Utah wrote to both of us. He said to Steve and Leo, I've been a Security Now listener since the single digits. And wow, that's okay. That's the beginning. So he says, but I did not buy a copy of SpinRite until my computer wouldn't boot because of some error. He wrote, whatever it was, SpinRite fixed it. Thanks, Steve. And then the reason that I had brought this up before was he said, also thanks for $728. After your first episode about Bitcoin in 2009, I decided to download it and fiddle around for a week. My computer was too weak to mine, M-I-N-E, but I did go to a website called the Bitcoin Faucet, which gave me 5 Bitcoin cents for free. I finally found my wallet in my backup drive, which, maybe thanks to SpinRite is still working, and I just sold them and netted $728. Nice. But he says, nice. By the way, it took my old computer 2 weeks to process the 157 gigabyte blockchain, which used to only be 250 meg when I got my 5 cents.
Exactly.
Anyway, I must say it pays to listen to Security Now.
Yes, it does. Very nice.
Very cool.
Happy ending.
So I have a couple closing the loop bits, feedback from our listeners, and then we will take our last break and talk about the speculation meltdown. Mike Gatsky, Gatsky. Sorry, Mike, if I mangled your last name. He wrote or tweeted, I've started using Firefox with the tree style tab add-on. Is there a way for Firefox to remember the tabs I have open? And so to Mike and anybody else, absolutely. I use an add-on called Session Manager, which is fabulous. It was written by the Mozilla developers, so they've nailed it. And because, you know, they have to know how Firefox works. And it is far more than just session management. That is, you know, you're able to take sets of tabs and save them. You can create named sessions. You can export sessions, you know, like email them to yourself and get them somewhere else. You can do all kinds of things with it. So anyway, I highly recommend it. I've been using it for years. Session Manager is the add-on. And then we will talk – actually, now we should talk about it probably because I'm going to talk more about theory than practice when we talk about the speculation nightmare. But this started with – well, of course, a lot of people had problems with what began happening with their computers. The first I saw of it was Richard J. Wilcox, who tweeted to me and to Simon Zarafa. He said, I had the same experience as reported in this article. And he quotes a securityaffairs.co posting. He said, the Microsoft update bricked, that's not quite the right term in this case, my AMD Athlon 64 X2 6000 plus computer. And so this was an article, one of many of AMD users, and you referred to this at the top of the show, Leo, who were having problems with the AMD Athlon. And also said the Semprons were doing the same thing. Woody Leonard got in on this dialogue in Twitter, and he tweeted, he says, I'm getting reports of a lot of AMD Win 7 machines blue screening, plus a handful of others. Intel, Win 10, various mixtures. No common theme as yet, except Win 7 AMD Athlons really took a hit. And of course, we know since then that Microsoft has officially stopped updating AMD and blamed AMD for this. I don't know if you saw that, Leo. But Microsoft has an official statement saying that the documentation which AMD provided to Microsoft has some errors, which is the reason that this bricking was occurring. And again, I've misused the term. What actually happens is that the reboot after the update will blue screen. Then Microsoft, you know, Windows will recognize it had a problem. It will try it again. And after, I think it's 2, might be 3, then it will do a self-rollback to the version that worked. But apparently that's a continuous loop. There was actually one funny posting that I got a kick out of. It was posted to the Microsoft forum. Someone wrote, I have older AMD Athlon 64 X2 6000 Plus ASUS motherboard after installation of, and then he quoted the knowledge base update that the knowledge base number, which is the one that we're all getting, the one that is, you know, causing problems, the system doesn't boot. It only shows the Windows logo without animation and nothing more. After several failed boots, it does a rollback. Then it shows error, and he shows a hex error, 0x800F0845. Unfortunately, he writes, it seems it's not easy to disable the automatic updates without group policy edit tweaks. So it tries installing and rolling back the update over and over. The, he says, SFC/scan now shows no problem. In place upgrade also doesn't seem to help. He says, I can try full reinstall, but I doubt it will change anything. It seems like the update is binary incompatible with my old CPU. Then here's what I got a kick out of. He says, I understand that making the machine unbootable is the best protection from remote exploitation. But I would rather have the OS working.
It is the best, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. If you can't get that machine to boot, nobody's going to get in there. So anyway, it's been a mess. I'm sure Microsoft and AMD are working together to figure out what it was that Microsoft didn't understand or that AMD posted incorrectly or provided incorrectly in order to fix this. And then I don't know what Microsoft will do. If you roll back, maybe, I don't know, I'm sure Microsoft must have some path through like un-blue screening these systems that keep trying to reload the same thing over and over. Maybe it will check to see if the patch has been changed. If Microsoft changes it, then it'll re-download one that no longer has the problem. But, you know, yikes, a bit of a nightmare for those people. Johnny Bryan said, I have an older Mac Pro as my main computer. The latest OS it can run is 10.11.6. It's not clear if Apple will patch this OS for meltdown, and then he links to a support.apple.com posting. Should I be concerned? Replacement is not an option. Should I disconnect it from the internet? And you know, that's a tough call. I'm of the opinion that the first of all, the exploitation now may not occur if meltdown has been mitigated. It's really only a problem. The performance overhead will probably not affect most typical users. It's largely a, you know, very active multitasking, multi-process systems where there's a lot of these ring transitions going on. I guess I would take a wait and see both on what Apple chooses to do and whether we see some chip support mitigations. There is the possibility of some chip support mitigation, although it may not, and early snapshots suggest they will not address meltdown, but will address the other speculation problems. So the only thing I could say, Johnny, is to wait and see. Certainly many people will be in your situation, and it's hard to imagine that Apple, you know, won't offer some sort of mitigation. So I don't know.
I'm sure Apple mitigate all of its devices. And,
yep.
And then there's always hope with the processor manufacturer, right? Because Intel and AMD and Qualcomm and everybody say they're going to do their own mitigations.
It's complicated, and we will be talking about that next.
Okay.
And it's not looking like, I mean, okay, so anyway, it's complicated, and so there's no easy way to summarize it. So we'll talk about that in a second.
Got it.
However, you'll remember our picture of the week last week, Leo, that we got such a kick out of, which was the fan blowing on the switching matrix.
But we couldn't read the fine print.
We couldn't read the fine print. Yeah. Well, leave it to one of our listeners who found from the dailywtf.com the so-called sophisticated cooling apparatus. By going back to the original picture and blowing it up, the fine print has been made legible because there's an asterisk in the warning that all UK TVs will be taken off the air. And the fine print says, asterisk, in a matter of minutes, probably. So that answers the mystery. It won't take long for this thing to overheat and cause a meltdown. Ian Beckett, who is a frequent correspondent, says, I'm wondering how vulnerable ARM controllers in SSDs are to Spectre, Meltdown, and the like. So I would say not at all. An ARM controller in an SSD isn't going to be running code that you download from the internet. I mean, that's really the danger, is that somehow malicious code will get into your will be running in a process in a multi-process system. Mostly cloud systems, I think, are in danger, but ARM controllers are not. And also,
they're probably not running user mode stuff at all, are they? I mean,
correct. They're probably not doing that. Also, for example, the Raspberry Pi is ARM based, but it too is not vulnerable because it is not using, it is using an ARM license, an ARM architecture that lacks speculation. So
same with the Apple Watch.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I would imagine the Raspberry Pi chose that because they didn't need that level of crazy performance, and it's a much cheaper license and a much smaller die size, thus much less expensive to fabricate an ARM that uses a much less expensive chip. So we're fine for embedded applications, which are certainly going to be using inexpensive controllers and not wide open the way cloud-based, Azure and AWS and the like, Google computing platforms are. Andreas Vital said, I just read that MongoDB noticed a 10 to 15% impact on HVM hypervisors from patches applied to their AWS infrastructure. That seems really high! Exclamation point. And as I've noted, that doesn't surprise me at all. What I think we're going to see is an initial reaction that has a stronger impact. And actually, I mentioned this, I guess, on Saturday on the new screensavers when I was on with you, Leo, at the beginning of the show, is that I think there will be an initial sort of panic reaction mitigation, and that as we get then chip level solution, although it's not clear that we're going to get that. Well, again, it's complicated, so I don't want to say something that is wrong. I want to cover it correctly in a minute, but again, that level of impact does not surprise me, because if it's necessary to flush the cache and the application, like a big database application, which may be crossing back and forth and doing a lot of low level or disk level I/O, that's the type of application that is going to see a larger end performance hit. Oh, and I just wanted to put this in here. Trevor Welch asks, why Security Now is not on Spotify, but other Twitch shows are. And I'm thinking maybe he just didn't see it, or, it would surprise me if it wasn't.
I'll check.
So,
yeah. I mean, it should be.
Yeah. And time for our last break, Leo, and then we're going to talk about the speculation meltdown.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. Our show today brought to you by those good people at Quicken Loans, number two lender. Well, it depends on what you're calling one or two, actually. Number two lender in terms of the loans outstanding, I think $92 billion in loans. Number one in your hearts. Number one in customer satisfaction, according to J.D. Power. They just got it again for 2017 in mortgage origination and mortgage servicing. Of course, it's, old hat now. They've won it 8 years running. So, these guys are great. I love them. Somebody asked me on the, I think the other day, well, is this related to Quicken the financial app? And no, the name's the same. And here's why. In 1999, Quicken bought a company called, I think, Rock Capital, that was run by this great guy, Dan Gilbert, and folded it into the Quicken family as Quicken Loans. 3 years later, Dan put together an invested team. He said, I don't like this. I'm going to do it myself, and bought it back. So since 2002, it's been owned by Dan Gilbert, and what a great team. These guys out of Detroit, Dan's a super techie. You probably heard about his plans to revitalize Detroit, and he's been doing it by bringing high-tech firms there. He's really cool. And they really like technology, which probably that number one lender in the country, the big bank. Well, let's put it this way. They think the state of the art is a stagecoach with horses. They're not exactly state of the art. So when it comes time to get a home loan or to refinance your existing mortgage, I'm going to recommend Quicken Loans. Great lender and a great new system they call Rocket Mortgage. That means you don't have to go to the bank. You don't have to meet anybody. You don't have to go to the attic or the cellar to find all your documents and your pay stubs. You don't have to call your other bank to say, hey, can you send me the statements from 2002? I don't know. And I know all this because I did it, because we did go with the Stagecoach guys when we bought our house 4 years ago, and it was a nightmare. It took us more than a month to get a home loan, and they kept coming back wanting more paperwork. Rocket Mortgage, if it takes more than 5 minutes, you have the right to say, this is taking too long. I mean, it's that fast, and you don't need to dig up stuff because you know the answers to all the questions. Here's what you do. You can do it right now. Even if you're not buying a house right now or refinancing right now, you can set up the account. Go to rocketmortgage.com/security now. rocketmortgage.com/security now. They've asked you some basic questions. They have trusted relationships with all the financial institutions, so they get the information they need with your permission from them. So you don't have to go digging around. You don't have to do anything. They say, okay, we got it. This year's, yep. They crunch the numbers, and based on your income, your assets, and your credit, they say, these are the loans you qualify for. And by the way, excellent competitive rates. You choose the down payment. You choose the term. You choose the rate. You get to pick. It's all completely transparent. And then they approve you. And all of this in a matter of minutes. You can do it on your phone. You could do it at an open house. You could say, you know what? This is a great deal. Let's buy this house, honey. Go to rocketmortgage.com/security now. Put in the answers. And then show the realtor. We're approved. We're approved. I love this. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. You better believe when it comes time to refi or buy, we're going to rocketmortgage.com/security now. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states and MLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. Rocketmortgage.com/security now. Big supporters of this show and all of our shows on Twit, and I'm a big supporter of them. I really appreciate their help. And you'd be doing us a solid if you go there the next time you're looking to buy. And just check it out, rocketmortgage.com/security now. Okay, Steve, we've been waiting all show long. It's time to talk speculative execution.
Show long and so long. Okay, so anyone who went back and reread our series on how processors work would have sort of encountered some of this, because we've talked about the phenomenal lengths to which modern processors now go in order to squeeze every last possible bit of performance out of their design in order to give us the kind of performance that we're used to getting now. Essentially every possible stop has been explored and removed. This notion of speculation, we've already pretty much talked about the meltdown problem, that the meltdown problem is the a way that was found of leveraging the caching of virtual memory pages, which are inherently shared globally, because there really hadn't been a reason not to. Now, I should mention that there is a feature in Intel's recent processors, PCID, and I referred to this last week. PCID is a page context identifier, which allows it basically solves the meltdown problem. If you've if you have and are you, if your OS is using the PCID, it is able to tag the pages with the identifier for the process, which provides the isolation which we need on a process versus OS basis without requiring the pages to be flushed. So the PCID support was added, I want to say 4.16 version of the Linux kernel. It is there. It has been ignored because nobody saw a particular need for it. Well, that changed last week. And the good news is when an operating system supports this PCID and when your chipset supports it, that's another part of the key, is that I don't remember now which family PCID appeared in, but it's been around for maybe a decade, but not before. So this is something that Intel added. Maybe it was prescient, or it's just sort of more thorough to be able to tag cached pages with the process ID is a good thing. So the kernel needs to support it. It exists in Linux. It has not been used until now. It will now be used, and will prevent this dramatic performance slowdown that we've seen. So that's why this is it's a little bit of a nuanced response. That huge drop in performance that we showed on the this week's picture of the week was a system that implemented the cache flushing mitigation for Meltdown, not PCID. It probably wasn't available. We don't know what OS they're running on. So that's something that I'm sure Windows will be getting soon if it doesn't already have it. Linux has it. It hasn't had it enabled, so I'm sure it will. And it does require that the chipset you're running on support this PCID capability, and really old ones don't, but it has existed in Intel chips for some time. So that's the Meltdown and this ability to use subtle timing in order to sense whether something is in the shared cache or not. Now, mentioning timing is useful because all that has to be done is that access to high resolution timing would solve this problem. That is, limiting access to high resolution timing. And I mentioned this also last week when we were first talking about this. It's not really clear that user mode, user land code, that is non-OS kernel stuff, in a production environment has to have access to the high resolution timer. There is it's called the RDTSC instruction on the Intel, read timestamp counter. And for example, I use it in Squirrel as just one more source of entropy, just another piece of data which is unpredictable and no external attacker, no one remote can have any idea how many cycles at whatever 3. Some gigahertz my particular instance or any of the Squirrel client users' instance of their processor has executed since it was booted. It'll never be the same twice. It'll never be the same even if you tried to make it the same, just due to all the other things going on. Things like where in its rotation the hard disk was, or where the hard disk's read head was as it was seeking. There's so much uncertainty in the system that having clock cycle level granularity is exquisitely fine. Well, that's useful as one of an addition of many sources of entropy, but it's that level of precision timing at you know, sub billionths of a second that the clock is running at. It's having access to that that allows the these attacks to occur, that allows software to discern with that exquisite granularity whether something was whether some data came from the local immediate access cache or even a you know had to be pulled out of main memory, which is much slower. And so if the instruction stalls in trying to fetch something, and then immediately after executing that instruction, it reads the timestamp counter again, it's able to discern that it stalled. It's able to sense that time passed while it was not executing, while the processor went out to get the data that was needed by the immediately preceding instruction. So there's an argument to be made that a solution to this would be to fuzz the resolution of the timestamp. That is, it's not clear that that there's any useful real world need for it. Maybe the OS needs it, but it's not even clear to me that it needs it at that level of granularity. It's there because it was, you know, it's in the chip. It's been there for a long time since one of the early Pentiums, I remember, that appeared. Spinrite has used it. When I was doing the sector reinterleaving in Spinrite 1, the only reliable source of time that was high granularity was this timestamp that has been there from the dawn of the Intel. So it's still there. And there are many other so-called performance counters which Intel makes available in their silicon to programs that want to execute it. Now, what's interesting is the read timestamp counter can be marked as privileged so that software cannot access it. On the other hand, unfortunately, there's no way to take it away from software now that presumes its presence. However, in a VM environment where you have virtualized hardware, the timestamp could be and is typically virtualized, which would allow it to be fuzzed. It would allow it to be made less accurate. And all you'd have to do was just add some uncertainty to it so that software cannot actually determine with the required level of certainty how long an instruction took to execute. And then this whole class of recently discovered problems disappears because the only way they're able to operate is to sense with absolute precision how long something took, which and again, it's not that the instruction didn't execute, it's just that it took a tiny bit longer in order for the system to fetch data out of main memory in the case of meltdown. So that's one potentially global fix. But to all of these problems. But this PCID is arguably the proper way to solve the problem of one process being able to sense the contents of a cache from another process. Again, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, it was like, that wasn't a problem. Today, it's a showstopper, which everybody is reacting to. So I think that the short-term extensive, you know, the short-term sort of knee-jerk reaction of flushing the cache whenever you go back out of the OS to the user, or maybe even cross-user, is going to be reduced once we get access and once operating systems are actively supporting this PCID flag on the caches, which solves that. But that's only one of the several problems. The other whole class of problem is speculation. As I started to say before, speculation is the notion of executing when you've got execution capability that is not in use. Okay, so for example, we've got multiple cores and hyper-threading technology on a state-of-the-art chip, whether it's Intel, AMD, ARM, doesn't matter. Say that you have, and I'll just use some simple algebraic equations to give an example. You have A plus B equals C, where imagine that these are registers, and D plus E equals F. In those two equations, the outcome C of the A plus B equals C is not used by the next computation, D plus E equals F. And the way processor engineers discuss this, they say there's no dependency of the outcome of the first by the second. So if those two simple math operations occur next to each other on a modern processor, it will notice that. It's smart enough. It's been engineered by state-of-the-art processor designers to see that it is, and imagine that B, A plus B equals C. Imagine that B is off chip at the moment. That is, it's in main memory. And so it's going to take a while for it to fetch the value of B in order to compute A plus B equals C. It looks ahead and it goes, oh, but look, D plus E equals F. And I got all of that data in my cache. And I don't need to wait to find out what C is because nobody cares in this next math operation. So the processor will do what's known as out-of-order execution. It will leap ahead. It'll start asking for B to be hauled in from main memory. Meanwhile, it'll go ahead. And as long as there is no dependency, it will move forward saying, well, nobody seems to be asking for C, so it'll just keep on executing as far as it can and as far as the architecture will allow it to get ahead, moving ahead. So out-of-order execution is one form of this. The other is branch prediction. If all code could only run in a straight line, it would be very limited in what it could do. Not completely limited. There are many instances where, for example, high-performance graphics processing does a whole bunch of stuff all at once that doesn't involve lots of branching. So you can get work done without branching, but ultimately you need to make some decisions. So here again, we have a situation where somebody, a sufficiently motivated engineer, could design, and they have designed, a system where the code is coming along and a conditional branch is encountered, meaning that the decision whether to take the left fork or the right fork in the code is dependent upon the value of something which is not yet known, like that C. Imagine that it says, well, if C equals zero, then go left, and if C is not equal to zero, go right. But we're still waiting to get that value of B in from main memory to add A to it to find out what C is before we know whether C is going to be zero or not. So what we could do is what's called a processor stall. We could just like say, shoot, we don't know C because we haven't got B yet. So, but again, in this interest of squeezing at, with any cost of effort, the absolute maximum technology out possible, the engineers say, well, instead of having to decide which path to take, let's take them both. And it's like, what? Yes. If we've got, again, excess computing resource, let's just go down both paths. The idea being,
it's not like branch prediction. They get both. In branch prediction, you pick one, and then there's a penalty if you pick the wrong one.
Yes. Now, there is branch prediction, too. I mean, so, like, there's that also.
Right.
But there's also, instead of taking the – and so that's like taking the road more traveled rather than road less traveled.
Right.
But you can also just say, let's go down both. And, again, the complexity, yes, it just – you know, it's just like – unbelievable how complicated the processes are today, because they have to keep track of everything they're doing down both paths, and when and like and make a like a checkpoint of like, okay, we're gonna go down both paths, but we have to make sure we don't screw anything up, because we have to be able to unwind any changes which end up being made by the path we don't end up taking once we finally get the result of the earlier math operation to tell us which branch we should have taken. And so it's like mind-boggling. But this is what state-of-the-art processors are doing. They are – and this is all collectively called speculation. You mentioned branch prediction. The idea being, and I refer to this, I guess, when we were talking about this on Saturday, Leo, the idea being that, you know, when you are, in general, caching works because the what has been known is that code generally runs in patterns, and data which is in use tends to get used again. Well, the instructions that are being executed also run in patterns. And so branch prediction is another form of caching. It notes that, gee, the code took this branch last time and the time before and the time before that. And so if it doesn't have enough resources to go down both paths, then because like other aspects are using the available resources, then it will settle for guessing the path likely taken based on what's happened recently. And so it'll go down the path that has been taken more recently, again, still making a checkpoint in case it has guessed wrong, because that is eventually going to happen. And it will go as far as it can based on how deep the speculation resources are in the chip. And if when the result of C is finally known, it checks and it says, oh, yeah, we're going down there again. Then it commits, or as in processor design terms, it retires. It's called retiring an instruction, meaning finally like saying, okay, fine, we're done with you. It will retire and commit all of those things it was kind of holding its breath about, waiting for the answer from the earlier question. So what we have is, we have in all of these things, we have caching, we have short-term memory of which branch is more like, which fork in the road is likely to be taken, and we have essentially a processor which is maintaining a huge amount of state, a huge amount of information of recent activity. That is, it doesn't know what happened last week. It only knows about what happened, you know, milliseconds ago as code is zipping around and zooming around in there. But that's enough to give it a huge performance advantage if it's able to guess right, or if it's able to speculate down multiple paths and like hold its breath, hold all of these possible outcomes. It's sort of like, you know, the multiverse, where it's like, oh, if a decision is being made, well, that causes the universe to split down both paths, you know, one where it happened and one where it didn't. Well, this is happening inside of our chips now. And once they're, you know, where decisions are being made later, which essentially affect the future, it's able to hold all outcomes and then commit the one that finally occurred and essentially leapfrog, you know, jump forward as long as it has sufficient resources. But the secret here is the problem, because doing this leaves footprints. Doing this alters the state of the processor. And today, those things, those alterations have global effect. That is, there is no flushing of all of this state when you change processes or change tasks, because nobody has really seen the need for it. Now, there are instructions that have been around for a long time in the Intel instruction set, which have not been much used. There's one called LFENCE, which explicitly allows speculation to be blocked. And there are various reasons why you want to sort of like force the chip into a known state, because multitasking and fine-tuned optimizations, there are places where you need to know what's going on, and so you sort of want to rein in the speculation. So this LFENCE instruction can be used at critical branch points to block speculation and prevent these kinds of speculation-based exploits. And in all of the reading that I did over the last few days, I ran across somebody who, and I think it was from Intel, so I was a little skeptical, because I remember that I sensed that they had a little bit of a bias in this. But the sense was that in the Linux kernel, there were only a few places where there was really this problem, where this LFENCE instruction could be inserted. There's been mention of compiler changes, which would cause compilers to start inserting these. Now, you want to do them sparingly, because it kills your performance. That is, we are relying on this level of speculation in order to have the performance our systems have today. And so if we start blocking speculative execution at every branch, suddenly something we're relying upon is gone, and we'll feel the performance hit. And we don't need to block it everywhere. We just need to determine where it matters. So that's why my feeling is we're at the beginning today of, and like this week, we are at the beginning of a somewhat lengthy process of dealing with the consequences of this revelation, which is that this speculation can be, and there, I mean, the proof of concepts have demonstrated that it is possible for code running in a user land to read about 2K bytes per second from the kernel. So it's not super high bandwidth, but it has been demonstrated. And so that's why everybody for the last few months has been running around with their hair on fire, quietly trying to get mitigations in place, because the second this became known, the hackers are going to try to take advantage of it. Intel has said that there will be forthcoming updates to the firmware in the chips. They're going to be introducing some additional instructions to give the low-level coders, the kernel developers, more control over speculation in order to mitigate these. Yesterday, the Intel CEO said that patches will come to 90% plus, that is more than 90% of Intel's chips in the next week, and that the rest of those by the end of January. So typically end users are applying OS patches and software patches, but not chipset patches. That needs to go through the chipset supplier. So I expect that we'll see Apple patching their stuff at the chip level. And I imagine people who have laptops and desktops with chipsets which are still being maintained from suppliers who are being responsible and still keeping the BIOS and the chip firmware up to date who knows how long it's going to take to get through the pipeline, weeks, months probably, but ultimately we should see a revamping of the firmware to create new instructions to provide additional granularity to speculation, where as we grow as an industry to understand the consequences of this, this begins to filter out and we basically roll back some of the freewheeling freedom that we've enjoyed for the last couple decades, not worrying about and not really recognizing the consequence of chips maintaining so much state in order to give us the kind of performance we've gotten accustomed to, and now suddenly recognizing and it going public that there is a way to sense that state which was put in place by other tasks running in the same system, and that creating an information leak. That's what it comes down to. So this is basically this is the big coverage of this now, and I'm sure that in coming weeks and months we will we'll be discussing the consequences, the actual consequences in terms of performance and mitigations, and where is Android, where is iOS, where is Mac, where is Windows, where is Linux, and where are all the various chipsets scattered through all of our machines. It is somewhat annoying that we can no longer rely upon the chipsets we have and that they're going to have to be updated. Note that the mitigations, and this is what I was trying to explain on Saturday more than last Tuesday, because this wasn't that clear. What will happen is the OS kernels will use a blunt mitigation which will cost us in performance but protect us, much like with Meltdown. But then when something like the PCID, the process context ID, is available in the hardware, then the OS will be able to back out of that blunt knee-jerk reaction to get back most of the performance by leveraging a feature of the processor that wasn't being leveraged. Well, that works for the PCID. What is going to happen with the firmware updates in our chips is new instructions which operating systems will then become aware of, which will allow us to stay secure while recovering performance that we have lost. So what this means is people who don't or are unable to update their processors' instruction sets with these additional instructions that allow fine-grained mitigation, they will see a performance hit and never be able to get the performance back. Essentially, it's like we were running on borrowed performance at the cost of security without knowing it.
They were saying Haswell and older chips are not going to be able to. But that doesn't even seem that old.
That's not that old.
Yeah,
yes.
It's a couple of years old, right?
Yes, that is exactly. Microsoft has a PowerShell script, which I don't know what the story is there. I made it the bit.ly link for this week. And then the zip file from Microsoft disappeared. Then it came back. Then it's gone again. I tried to use it last night when I found it, and it didn't work. So they've been having all kinds of trouble. There is a very small and clean utility on GitHub. It's called SpecuCheck, SpecuCheck. I've been watching it. I've been following its development. Because I just haven't had time, I haven't had time to build it myself. But I have absolutely no reason to mistrust this person. If you do specucheck/releases, Leo, go to /releases to that URL. You will find releases as of the time of this podcast at 1.0.4, where he has the XE. So anybody who is skeptical is welcome to compile their own executable from the source. It's there both in zip and tar format, and the executable for people who can't compile their own. It's 80K. That's what I recommend people use. It looks very clean. He's improved the documentation on his source. And what this does is probe the chip you're running for all of these specular execution mitigations and the OS that you're on. That is, it is a Windows XE. So for Windows users, this is what I think you want to use, is SpecuCheck. It will allow you to verify both before and after a firmware update to a microcode update to your processor, whether or not it supports these features, and whether or not the OS is basically in blunt mode, which is costing you performance, or recognizes that your processor has the required features if it does, and whether the processor is aware of that and is using them. So, this is the best we have now. Again, I'm sure this is not the last we'll be talking about this. I mean, this is, as I said, this is truly a major event for the industry that impacts security and costs us performance, because it is because these features give us performance that we've had the performance we have. But it's the nature of the way we've achieved that performance that inherently, which has been global for the chip, which inherently costs us security. We're going to immediately get the security back at a short-term cost of performance that we then may be able to recover in the future. Certainly,
whenever I run it, it just crashes out, moving forward. It opens a window and it goes away. So I'm not.
Oh, sure. No. Yes. You need to. I'm sorry. Unfortunately, this is not a Windows app. So you need to open a command line.
Okay.
A command line, right. And then manually run it from the command line, right. And it'll dump out a bunch of text. I would love to write one of my little Windows apps for this, but I'm going to keep on squirrel and assume that others are going to write a nice. Windows tool because it's simple to do in order to show people what's going on with their chip and their system.
So I just ran it and yes, it says mitigations for CVE-5754, which you can't really read this, which is rogue data cache load. Yes for shadowing, but no for user pages marked global. This is with all the Microsoft patches on here. And a lot of no's for 5715, which is branch target injection. In fact,
that's what we're going to be getting some firmware updates, some microcode updates.
No's aren't necessarily bad.
Yeah, exactly. As long as there's coverage elsewhere.
Yeah, kernel shadow.
Yeah, and again, the unfortunately, this is a bit on the techie side. I'm hoping that somebody will come up with something
that
makes it clear.
Yeah, But at least you can do this.
I'll steal a day and write one that makes it clear.
Yeah, branch prediction mitigation is enabled. No. Disabled due to system policy registry. No. So that's that key you were talking about. Disabled to lack of microcode update. Yes. So I guess I'm waiting for a microcode.
We all are, Leo. We're all waiting. It's going to be, when the problem is Intel having it available doesn't mean that it is applicable, unfortunately, because it's got to come through our platform vendor, Lenovo, for example, or whatever motherboard we're using.
Yeah,
so
it's not clear what you want to see on these results. So I
know it's unfortunate that it's not more clear. Yeah. It's all we've got right now. But again, I think a week or two from now, it'll be made more clear. And if it's not, I'll steal a day and write one that is clear.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. That's good. I want one for the Mac now. I guess I could look at his code. It looks like it's C code, so it's probably not.
No, it is. It is. It's just pulling information from a couple of the model specific registers in order to figure out what's going on. And again, anybody who doesn't trust it can write their own. I'm sure we'll see several tools out in no time to make this clear.
I'm getting exactly the same results as his screenshot, interestingly enough. So I hope he explains it.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Interesting. I wonder if this would work. Does it require the Windows kernel or is it just calling? I think it's probably Windows only. Okay. Good to know. Good tool as usual. Good information. And what it really does is it's kind of like Apple's battery problem. It kind of requires everybody with anything Haswell and older to upgrade.
Yes.
Jeez.
Yes.
That's terrible.
Or suffer a probably noticeable performance hit. End users may not get hit. That's the good news. But cloud platforms, hopefully they're on more modern hardware and or they have the clout to get the firmware and the microcode update that they need. So anyway, we'll be writing this one for some time to come, I'm sure.
Jeez. So Haswell's from 2013. So it's fourth generation. We're up to eighth. So yeah, if you bought a computer in the last, more than 4 years old, you're kind of out of luck.
Yep.
Holy cow.
You can be secure, but you cannot be fast.
Right. Wow. Well, there you go. You've heard it here. Thank you, Steve. As always, Steve Gibson, you can find him on the Twitter. And I know there's a lot of traffic on the Twitter about all of this, at SGGRC. You can also DM him. He accepts DMs from anybody. Unlimited length there if you have something to say or a question. You can also go to his website, grc.com. Leave questions at grc.com/feedback. While you're there, pick up SpinRite. You have to. If you have a hard drive, you need SpinRite, world's best hard drive recovery and maintenance utility, even for SSDs. You can also check out all the work he's doing on Squirrel and the passwords. I use your passwords all the time. That 64-character password generator is really great. On and on and on. It's all that stuff's free, including your copy of Security Now. He offers 64 kilobit MP3 audio, plus very nice transcripts written by Elaine Ferris at grc.com. We have audio and video at our website, twit.tv/sn. And you can, of course, subscribe. You'll get exactly the same audio if you subscribe on any podcast program. And just make sure you do, because you want to get every episode as soon as it's available, which usually is later on, late in the day, Pacific time, Tuesday. We record, if you want to watch it live, Tuesdays at 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 21:30 UTC. And if you do watch live, by all means, join the chat room. They are awesome, and it's a great way to get, kind of some additional information, some back channel, and some socialization during the show. irc.twit.tv. If you want to be in the studio, you can do that as well, but please don't surprise us. We don't like surprises. Just email tickets@twit.tv, even if it's just an hour ahead of time, just to let us know you're on your way. We'll make sure we have some space for you. tickets@twit.tv. Thank you, Steve Gibson. Wow. Wow, wow, wow. Great show once again, and we will see you next week on Security Now.
Thanks, Leo.
Security.